Okay, grab your Bible, head to Joshua 24. We are at the end of our first book for 2026, and wrapping up today the book of Joshua that contains maybe the most famous verse in the book.
Well, chapter one, that whole be strong and courageous is a pretty good candidate too. But yeah, but the me and my house, yeah.
Maybe we should say.
This is the more cross-stitched.
It's the most refrigerator door magnet.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Yeah. It's cross-stitch and signs put up in the house.
Yeah, most quotable.
Maybe the first question to answer is whether or not 24 is a new gathering or a continuation of the previous gathering. Thematically, the chapters go together. We said that last week. That you have Joshua, in essence, saying goodbye to the nation. But 24 begins with essentially the same statement that 23 began with, that Joshua gathered Israel. And the only added piece here is that a place is identified, which has some significance.
Well, yeah, the place matters. The place is Shechem, and the place matters. You know, if you notice right after, you know, the introduction of Joshua gathering, the list of kind of high officials, the place given, starting in verse 2, Joshua actually here goes back to the history of, you know, Abraham being called when he lived beyond the Euphrates.
Right.
And so by going back to the Abraham story and the promises, and the God had promised Abram this land to possess, as you're going to go through this kind of recitation of their history from calling Abraham out of Mesopotamia down to the present moment. Doing it at Shechem matters because if you go back to Genesis chapter 12, after
the beginning of the Abraham story.
The beginning of the Abraham story, after God had called him, Shechem is kind of the first place that Abram pulls off the road in Canaan, if you will, once he gets there, you know, stops at the Bucky's there in Shechem or something. And I know.
I have nothing nice to say about on that. Yes.
But no. But it's the first place that Abram named place that Abram stops in the Canaan and builds an altar and worships the Lord there. And so it's like literally, you know, when Abram still has no control of the land, and again, God's going to, you know, say, you know, look, you know, basically, you're going to get all this someday, or your descendants are going to get all this someday. And so God is reiterating these promises, you know, all this to Abram. Shechem is where Abram first stops and builds an altar to God when he arrives in the land, as far as Genesis tells the story. And so for Joshua now, on the other end of this long arc of promises kept, you know, now they are a great nation. Now they possess the land. To come back to Shechem and say, "Hey, remember the story? It's finished. God has accomplished what He said. And, you know, in this way, in this level, God has accomplished what He said He was going to do for Abraham. And here we are today."
Shechem kind of bookends the land promise.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
This is the whole story of how we got the land. It begins
right.
in 12, and it ends here. Genesis 12 and
right.
in Joshua chapter 24.
Right.
It is interesting that as you go through the history that he picks up with in verse 2, and you go down to verse 13, which I think is kind of a segment, right?
Right.
Of the introduction.
Oh, absolutely.
Reciting the history. But there is a land emphasis all the way through
right.
this section.
Right.
He brings up land again and again and again, whether it's talking about the land beyond the river are the land of the Canaanites, where they're dwelling now. He talks over and over again about land through this segment.
Right, and thus, you know, why Joshua wants us to know it's at Shechem he's doing this huge component and this symbolic place. Though you do have, you know, kind of Deuteronomic language from Deuteronomy slipping in as well, verse 13, you know, lands you had not labored, cities you had not built to dwell in them, eat of fruits, you know, eat the fruit of vineyards and olive orchards you did not plant. And so some of that blessing language from Deuteronomy creeps in there as well to kind of put the law and the covenant into the perspective. It's promise, and it is also covenant that kind of sits over them now.
Yeah, and even though the emphasis, I think, is on the land, you're right. There are some other things in here, like God's repeated reminder of what I did for you.
Right.
You are here today because from the time of Abraham, I took your family, and I through all that ordeal, and I brought you and planted you in that land, which ties nicely with what he told them in the previous chapter about, you know, you need to be faithful to me, and you need to finish the job,
right?
And you need to eradicate the enemy from the land. And that really then picks us up with 14 and the second segment of this, and that is this rather famous call to be faithful.
Right. You know, and you know, this is the move we forget a lot in the Bible. Because we emphasize our willing response, and rightly so. You know, you have to respond to the gospel and be baptized. You have, you know, we emphasize our responses, but we forget that there's only a call to response because of what God did first.
Correct.
And so, you know, the first part of the chapter, you know, even the way verse 12 begins to wrap it up, it was not by your sword or by your bow. You know, God makes promises to Abraham. God calls Abraham. Then even, you know, in keeping the promises, I mean, he has them go out and swing a sword, but, you know, but the reality is it's God with them is why they are, you know, why the walls fall down, why, you know, so... Why, when they admittedly were afraid of going into land that first generation because of the giants, because of everything else, you know, now they really are able to do it. It's because God's with them. So having God having done his part in movement toward them, just like, you know, the truth of the matter is, baptism is essential for salvation, but yet baptism only works because God first, when we were not looking for him, as Paul talks about in Romans, you know, the godly and the righteous die for the ungodly. God makes the first move. God's made the move and making the promises and keeping the promises, but now comes the call for them collectively to make the right response, which is no other gods. Deal with the idolatry, deal with your propensity to worship, you know, and be part of what everybody else is doing religiously, and worship me and me alone and the way that I have established.
This is interesting because it really is on the part of Joshua speaking for God and Israel speaking for themselves. It's each side repeating their terms of the covenant. There's a real Exodus 19 feel here.
Right.
When God very first calls them and said, if you will hear my voice and keep my covenant, then I will. And he goes on to talk about the things that he would do for them. And so you have a list of what God has done. And I love the response of the people to the call. Verse 16, far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. And then they kind of give their own more brief rehearsing of the history. And so picking up at 18, the Lord drove out from before us all the peoples, even the Amorites who lived in the land. We also will serve the Lord, for he is our God. So you have kind of that, you know, each side's kind of stating their part in this covenant that they have with each other.
Right. But then comes verse 19, which is, you know, kind of Joshua and God, I think, ultimately.
He's messing it up. That's such a good moment,
yeah,
and then Joshua said, "Nah, you're not going to do it."
Let's be real and let's be honest. You know, you already collectively don't have the strongest history as a nation. You know, even though it's only been two generations, so to speak, so far.
Right.
And so you really, you know, no, your history even already of forsaking other gods is not good. You know, whether it's Rachel stealing the household idols from Laban on the way. You know, Amos will later on make the point, you know, when God later on in their history says, I knew you had idols in your tent even in the wilderness. I knew even in the wilderness after the Exodus, before you even got in the land, you had some idols. The golden calf episode. I mean, just, you know, on and on it goes. And the truth is, we, human nature in general, we are, you know, as one early Christian writer put it, you know, the human heart is an idol making factory.
Yeah.
It just is. And so Joshua says, "Look, you know, guys, it's easy to say, but let's be realistic. It's real easy in this really feel good moment to say, yep, gonna do it."
And twice they say that.
Oh yeah,
and actually three times in the whole context.
And then Joshua says, "You know, kind of like Peter, I will never deny you." You know, Joshua, guys, you need to be a little more realistic about who you are, already.
Well, what the preacher says at the end of the sermon. Okay, now what are you going to do when you go home? And literally in this case, verse 23, what are you going to do about those idols you have at home? Which is, I think at this point in reading this, it's astonishing because of how utterly committed they are, they say they are, to serving the Lord. And Joshua's response is, okay, well, then you got to go home and get rid of the idols that are in your house right now.
Right.
And that's kind of shocking, I think, to the reader, at least to the reader today, to say, wait a minute. As they're saying, we're going to serve the Lord, they literally have the idols at home.
Right.
And I don't know. Do you feel a little solace there to know that sometimes they wrestle with the same hypocrisy Well, yeah. With today.
Well, and just, you know, whether it's you know, just the lack of self-awareness, whether it's the lack of, you meant my idol. I mean, it's just a little idol, you know, right? I mean, you know, the big ones, you know, the big public ones are one thing, you know, the golden calves are one thing, but my little bedroom idol is something entirely different. Just, but, you know, and I still come and worship God, you know, the, you know, keep the Sabbath, you know, that way we can rationalize, wait, you're talking about my little idol too. You're not just talking about the big ones or yours. That human ability to rationalize, justify, deceive ourselves, lack of self-awareness, you know, again, it's nothing new about this.
And it's interesting to me that Joshua is not going to let them get away with giving the right answer.
Yeah.
He's going to make them live the right answer. And I think that's why you have him pressing this in this section. Don't just tell me what I want to hear. And I think that's sometimes the trap we fall into. We think because we say the right words that we've done the right thing. And Joshua's saying, no. Okay, this is what you've promised.
Yeah.
Now let me make the application of the sermon.
Yeah.
That means you got to leave this gathering. You need to go home and you need to destroy those idols. Literally, that as we have this conversation, sit in your house.
Right.
So powerful. I think very, very powerful sermon. And I like the way he holds their feet to the fire, which I think speaks to us today. Because I don't think that kind of preaching is very popular.
No.
Especially in the broader religious world. And I think if we're not careful, sometimes we're kind of looking at them and thinking our preaching needs to look like what is happening in the broader religious world. This is the kind of preaching that God wants done for his people. And that is call them to obedience, call them to
and repentance.
Truly honor the covenant.
Absolutely. Well, and to that end, David, you know, people are okay with general applications when we preach. I think sometimes it's, you know, where it gets a little bumpy is when we get too specific in application, and then somebody, you know, his toes get stepped on, because we're not just talking about generically have no other gods. We're talking about your idols. You know, it's really saying no other gods. It's a thing to say, but and that includes this particular idol.
Yes.
This is still an idol. You know, you may have justified, rationalized, whatever, but this is actually still an idol too. It's got to go. It's the specifics that always kind of get people, you know, that challenge our clear-sightedness about ourselves and about what God is asking.
You know, there's teaching that needs to comfort and console people and make them hopeful and make them joyful. But candidly, folks, if you're never getting your toes stepped on and never getting called out for something that you're doing and challenged to change and be different and more Christ-like, that's not biblical preaching.
Yeah.
Because biblical preaching requires that. At least at times. And so the other thing I love about 24 is that we don't just link back up with Genesis 12 and the promise to Abraham.
No.
But at the very end,
very important,
we link up with the last couple of chapters of Genesis, mm-hmm. 48, 49, 50, and the end of the Joseph story.
Yeah.
Where when Joseph died, and I love this story, by the way, where he is very careful to say to the people, don't leave my bones here.
Yeah.
And it was sort of this reminder to all generations that God's going to keep his promise, and your future is not in Egypt, it's in Canaan. And when the time comes, I don't want you to leave my bones here. I want you to take my remains, and I want you to bury them in the promised land. And you know, we know from the Exodus story that's exactly what they did.
Yeah.
In fact, I've always thought it was funny that it was someone's job to carry Joseph's coffin for 40 years,
yeah,
wandering in the wilderness.
Yeah.
And that visual reminder of, here's our ancient forefather who believed in the promise. And now here at the end, that actually comes to pass as Joseph asked. So you kind of, this is technically the end of the Joseph story.
Yeah.
At the end, they bury his bones.
Well, and just looking at the little details there in verse 32, as they're burying the bones, obviously Shechem's significant. Again, they're burying them at Shechem. But, you know, that little details that are there that don't have to be there. Originally, this land had to be bought.
Correct.
Now it's theirs. You know, originally back in the day, Jacob had to buy the land that is being used for burial here around Shechem. But now it's actually theirs, all of it. They don't buy for it or pay for it anymore. There it is. I think the other thing that's powerful about Joseph, you know, he's such a good man and held up, you know, I think implicitly held up as an exemplar there in Genesis. And the fact that he was so successful in Egypt, in the world, so to speak, and yet never became at home in Egypt, you know, literally wants to be buried where he's really from. and thus associated with it and shows his still identity is with the patriarchs and with the promises of God. He may have to live his life in Egypt because of God's providence. You know, you meant it for evil, God meant it for good. I know God's at work in my life and using me this way. But my heart, no matter how rich, how successful, how powerful he became in Egypt, his heart to the end was back in the land with the promises that God had made to his, you know, his forefather, Abraham. And that, I think that's powerful.
Yeah, he was content to be a sojourner.
He even though he was powerful and rich in Egypt and could have very easily, you know, I wasn't born here, God, as fast as I could with Egypt. His heart is back with God's people, God's plan, God's purposes, God's covenants, God's promises.
Yes, and I think in that sense, his life parallels our own.
Yeah.
That we have to have that same spirit about even living in Texas, that this is the temporary residence,
yeah.
This isn't home, and that our future lies,
yeah.
Future lies elsewhere. We have some other death at the end of chapter 24.
The end of an era, the end of a generation.
Yeah, yeah. You kind of have a gentle way of talking about Joshua and the elders,
mm-hmm.
Kind of coming to their end, and then 33 closes with Eliezer dying and being replaced.
By Phidias.
Yeah. And so you just, it's like it ends with the dying off of that generation and setting the table
for
the generation that is to come. And so it might be interesting to finish 24 and then immediately go on into Judges and kind of read the beginning of Judges chapter 1, which we'll begin next week, which begins to sort of piece together what happens when you don't do what God said to do.
Well,
and after this great moment of victory and success, the very next thing that happens is we go off into this dark period. Has God warned them?
Well, and just to me, one of the most subtle and serious warnings that comes is how hard it is from one generation to the next to hand off faith and zeal and commitment. You know, Joshua, Eleazar, the elders of that generation, you know, obviously, you know, were successful in doing what they needed to do in their own time. Handing it off to the generation behind them, yep. is what gets us the book of Judges, you know, and on down there. And so just, you know, strong one for those just raising kids, you know, fathers and mothers, you know, just really understanding the challenge of from one generation to the next.
And the danger of victory.
Yeah, yeah, making it too easy for our kids when it goes too well, too long.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and just being in that place, right?
Yeah.
Just having been successful. And instead of saying, okay, we've reached this hill, but it's not the top of the mountain. It's,
yeah.
It's the plateau, and there's another hill in front of us, which was for that generation, finish the job,
yeah.
Drive out the other nations. And sometimes we get content with this victory, and we don't go on to the next thing we're supposed to do.
Right.
And so as we move into Judges, we're going to find out how all that works out. So Joshua 24 this week as we wrap up. Maybe look ahead a little bit and grab a little bit of Judges 1 and watch how the two books link together.